resurrection, expecting a renewal, something new in our lives. And yet, how do we get there if we don't prepare? So that's what Lent is about. So the first Sunday of Lent, I spoke about our desire for renewal, and I asked this question: what do you long for? What is it deep in your soul that you long for? And if you were humble enough to recognize any need for change in your life and ask God for that change, what is it you would ask for? Last week, I said that we need to look at what we long for, and then we need to set an intention or a destination, or if you will, a goal for something you want. A goal that is God-shaped and God-sized, that would actually take the rest of your life to live into. Not a goal that will give you any kind of external or material benefits, but it gifts you with life because you begin to live into who you actually were meant to be. It's God-shaped because it transforms you more into the likeness of Jesus. It makes you better for yourself, for others, and the world. And in a culture that actually teaches us to be superficial and not look deeply at our lives, religion coming from the word connection, connects us to our true selves. Religion connects us to who we are supposed to be. We are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, our hearts, our souls. So the transformation that we are seeking is not anything outward. It's always inward. What would that be? What would that be for you? Is it perhaps gaining a sense of peace or an overall health or gaining some wisdom? Is it growing deeper in faith and trust and acceptance? Is it learning to love and accept yourself more? Not to beat yourself up too much. Maybe you want to live with more compassion and understanding, or maybe you long for more lightness in your life and for joy. Whatever it is that we long for, it will be an inner work of transformation that requires a clear sense of how you will live in the world and what you can be. Once you have this desire clearly articulated for yourself and set in your heart, it will be a journey that will take you not only to Easter, but beyond Easter. Because Easter isn't really a day in the calendar like we think it is, but it is the day that you realize that you are in fact becoming more of what you long for and are on this new, more fulfilling journey through life. Which brings me to today's step in the journey. The preparation or the steps that you will need to take in order to get to where you want to be. In other words, how you will build into your life the things you can do to get you to that Easter place. The structure and practices you will create that will protect you, that will help you gain what you need to live out the life you long for. It will create a core identity and keep you on course. What is the structure you need to create for that? So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about Nehemiah, and we'll connect it to this message. I like Nehemiah. I've always liked Nehemiah. Probably some of you have never heard about him, but I somehow, when I was studying scripture, kind of fell in love with Nehemiah. I really like him. Not the least of which, because he won me a history award in theological school. About 1,000 years before Jesus comes on the scene, the great Jewish king, Solomon, builds the very first temple in Jerusalem. Now, the temple for the Jews is a really, really big deal, because it not only solidified the Jewish people as a nation, it was actually essential to their identity as a people of one God, and it cemented in their minds their place in the world. The temple is extraordinarily important. You cannot underestimate the place that Jerusalem has in the Jewish psyche. Their lives revolved around the temple. They traveled great distances by foot to worship there and to sacrifice there. It became the center of their existence, their national existence, the place where God was most present to the people. So generations after this temple is built, the people worship there and become a strong nation built around Jerusalem and the temple. However, about 400 years after that temple is built and the nation becomes strong, another nation, the Babylonians, sack Israel and particularly Jerusalem, and they leveled the temple. They destroyed the temple and they exiled many of the educated and powerful people of Israel, leaving behind just a meager remnant of what they were, this once vibrant kingdom. And the people are devastated. You know the song by the rivers of Babylon where we sat down and that comes from this. Their identity is in tatters because the temple is destroyed. And in that place of exile, all that these people longed for was a return to their land and to rebuild the temple, which gave them their identity and their sense of purpose in the world. So they're in Babylon longing for a return to Israel. A few generations after the Babylonian exile, along comes another power, Persia. Anybody heard of Persia? Anybody know what it's connected to today? Iran. It is in the seeds of Persia becomes the nation of Iran. And Persia comes along and they defeat the Babylonians, and along with it, they inherit Israel and all of the exiled Jews that had gone to Babylon. However, the Persian regime itself was much more tolerant of various religions, and for the most part, they sent many of the exiles from many of their countries back to their original lands and allowed them to worship their original gods. But this is not without conflict for the Jews or Israelites, because when they go back, other people have settled their land, and they're not really keen on the Jewish people to come back and rebuild the temple. But the first wave of people who returned to Jerusalem managed to rebuild the temple, but the hostility that was taking place of many competing groups still made the temple itself vulnerable and the people vulnerable, and its continued existence was in question. A priest at the time, Ezra, had returned with the people and was leading the people certainly in worship and in their law and a recovery of their identity, but this place of worship, their temple, and their practice was not very stable. They were threatened by hostile neighbors and had to fight to remain there. They longed for some sense of safety and protection. Enter Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a faithful Jew, but he is in the service, basically a slave, to the Persian king Artaxerxes. He is actually the cupbearer of the king. That is, he looked after all the king's wine and served the wine at the king's meals. And by all accounts, at least scriptural, Nehemiah was a pretty popular guy. He was well-loved and quite cheerful. And as a slave, he had it pretty good in Persia. However, he was faithful to his faith and still very attached to Jerusalem and the temple in ways that few today could possibly understand how important that temple is, although we do get pretty attached to our buildings. So when Nehemiah is quite aware of these troubles in his homeland and with his people, he is quite concerned. And one day he shows up at the dinner of the king, and the king notices that Nehemiah is different. He's not quite his cheerful self. And the king, Artaxerxes, says to Nehemiah, "What's going on, Nehemiah? You seem sad. Something's going on with you." And Nehemiah, with a because he is fearful of saying anything to the king. Finally says to the king, gets up his courage and says to the king, you know, the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. My people are back there trying to hold on to what they had, but it's really hard for them. They're really threatened, and I am sad about that. And the king actually listened to him and said, so what can I do about it? And Nehemiah says, you can do something about it. He said, can you let me go? Can you let me go back there to Jerusalem? I will come back, but can you let me go there? I want to build walls around the temple. I want to build back the walls, the safety of the temple. And actually, Artaxerxes listens to him and says, okay, you can go back. And then Nehemiah, a little emboldened by his request, says to the king, do you think you could write a letter for me? Because you're the king of all these things. Can you write a letter for me and tell all of those, you know, all of our enemies that we're allowed to do that, that we're allowed to rebuild the walls? And the king says, yeah, I can do that. And he said, and if you're going to do that, could you tell them to give us all the supplies we need to build the walls? And Artaxerxes does that. He sends a letter with Nehemiah back to Jerusalem with this one man who had been a cupbearer, a slave in Persia, and says, I empower you to go and build those walls. You have my permission. The king asked him how long he'd been gone. He gives him an estimate of how long he'll be gone, and the king sends him off to Jerusalem to build the walls. And here's how he does it. He gets the supplies together, he takes the letter, and he pulls together families and groups of people, and he said, each family, each group, including men, women, children, priests, everybody, you are going to be assigned one section of the wall. And each group is going to build one section of the wall right up to the next person, the next group, and keep building the wall all at the same time. And that's exactly what they did. Section by section, they built the wall that surrounded the temple. And they finished it in 52 days. We couldn't even do that. It wasn't easy. They were threatened by those opposed to the project. And they had to assign, along with the groups of people, people who would stay around the guard, the people who were building, with swords because they were attacked once in a while. But they got the wall built. They worked hard, very hard, to protect their identity, their place of worship, their faith, and their hope for the future. The temple and the walls that protected the temple ensured that the Jewish people could remain centered in their faith and their collective identity amid a hostile and challenging environment. They had created a safe space to worship and to be themselves. About 400 years after that, after the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple, a man named Jesus came along. And he told his followers that the temple of God is within you. This is the new temple of God. That within all of us is the temple of God. We contain the light of God in every single one of us. God resides in us. Our desire, our greatest desire and longing, is to know the nature of light within each one of us, the nature of love within each one of us, and to find ways to protect the beautiful, precious, loving, good people that we are meant to be. To recognize that we are God bearers. This is our identity. This is the strength of who we are. So we need then to build supports and practices that will protect our inner work, help us to become who we actually are. And that's my question then this morning. What do you need to build into your life in order that you will know who you are? You can become the fullness of who you can be. What practices will support you on your journey? Whatever they are, build them into your lives one section at a time. Start with one piece of the wall and build on it. Do you need to develop some new habits? Or give up some old habits? Do you need to learn new skills? Let go of some of your old ways? Or seek professional guidance? Recruit people to support you? Take a course. What do you need to build into your life to become the best person you can be? What will support your work of becoming better for yourself and better for others? Because the world desperately needs people who go deep rather than stay superficial. Take your time. Set your sights on the rest of your life and what you can become. Small steps over time really do lead to significant transformation if we keep working at it. Nehemiah had a plan. He went with a plan, and step by step, he carried it out with help. And he saw it through to the end, even though it was really hard and threatened. Whatever it takes, set your sights on what's important and build a good life that is worthy of your time and effort. It requires intention and discipline, which is why we often give up. Margaret Wheatley, in her book Perseverance, says that discipline is the key to our success, not passion. Discipline. Doing the necessary things over and over and over in our lives that will build us up. And they may be boring and not very sexy. But one day we will realize that those things have brought us to a new place, to a place of life, of new life, of transformation, of resurrection. Margaret Wheatley says, propelled by passion rather than by discipline, we end up spent, exhausted, and unhappy. And we lose the capacity to persevere if we have no discipline. Persevere. Do the things you need to do to fulfill your longing. Life offers us so much when we are willing to do the things, the hard things that need to be done. Easter is close, very close, right here. We carry it within us, and we can discover new life if we want it enough. The question is, do we? Do we? Let's take a moment for reflection.